Rocket engines are interesting. They're extremely difficult to build, but the basic concept is simple enough for a child to understand. Any rocket engine throws out exhaust as fast as possible. The faster the exhaust, the faster the rocket. Practically, this means getting as much energy as possible into a thrust chamber and using it to provide kinetic energy to the exhaust. Conventionally, this is achieved by burning fuel. Rocket fuels, therefore, are necessarily pretty hazardous, with most designs burning kerosene, hydrogen, or methane in the presence of liquid oxygen. There isn't much margin for error when handling these explosive propellants, but there are propellant combinations that offer further performance improvements. Unfortunately, they come with even more risk. Why would anyone want to chase a marginal performance gain at the expense of gaining a full house at chemical hazard symbol bingo? I've heard rocket engineers being described as the engineeriest of engineers. So naturally, in 1968, a team of them didn't ask why, they asked, why not?
If these propellants are so hazardous, why use them? These fuel combinations have a high specific impulse, that is, a high level of thrust per pound of weight. Because they are hypergolic, ignite on contact, the need for a special ignition system is eliminated, and the engine restart capability is enhanced.
Today we'll be discussing the best performing rocket engine ever tested. Along the way, we'll discuss deadly neurotoxin, a reactor meltdown, lasers, and many, many chemical hazards. Before we get started, this video is an hour long. With any amount of proofreading and triple checking, I'm still bound to make minor mistakes somewhere. If you spot one, please let me know in the comments. But I ask that you check the pinned comment first. I'll include any known mistakes there. As always, sources are in the description. Now, I dislike the phrase best performing, as there are many ways to define performance. What I'm really referring to is specific impulse, abbreviated to ISP.
That is a measure of the kinetic energy an engine can gain from a given mass of fuel.
In real world terms, and all other factors equal, the higher the specific impulse, the more mass a rocket can get into orbit. The units for specific impulse are seconds, which sounds odd, but it actually provides a nice interpretation. The specific impulse is the amount of time an engine can accelerate its initial mass, including the propellant, at 1g of acceleration. Let's compare some well-known first-stage engines. Kerosene liquid oxygen engines can manage specific impulses of up to about 350 seconds. The Mighty F1 engines used on Saturn V had ISPs of 304 seconds. A more modern example is the Merlin used on Falcon 9. The latest iteration manages 311 seconds. For reasons we don't need to get into now, the propellant combination currently in vogue is methane and oxygen. SpaceX hold the record for the highest ISP achieved for a methane-oxygen engine, with the Raptor at 363 seconds. This was achieved through a complex design that uses full-flow staged combustion, something we absolutely are not going to get into now. The propellant combination with the best specific impulse that has actually been flown is hydrogen and oxygen. The RS-68 engines used on the Delta IV managed 414 seconds of specific impulse. These were relatively simple open-cycle engines. None of the complexity of staged combustion was necessary to achieve that value. And taking the crown for highest specific impulse for a flown engine, the fantastic RS-25, also known as the Space Shuttle main engines. Any excuse to mention the RS-25 on this channel. These combined the complexity of staged combustion with the high energy density of hydrogen and oxygen to achieve a stunning 452 seconds of ISP.
Whoa, okay, slow down there, Alex. It turns out the RD-0120 engines from the Energia had a slightly higher vacuum ISP than the RS-25s. As much as I'd love to discuss Energia and Buran now, I'd probably need 2 hours to do that topic justice.
let's save that one for a future video. I should quickly say, a higher ISP doesn't necessarily mean more payload to orbit. Hydrogen oxygen launch systems require additional insulation and plumbing, which translates to more mass and more drag. Payload to orbit is a complex balance between many factors. You'll notice three of the five engines on screen were built by Rocketdyne, and they also built the engine we'll be discussing today. Contrary to what I said in the intro, this is not a marginal improvement. In terms of specific impulse, it left everything else in the dust with a whopping 542 seconds, the highest value achieved for any chemical rocket to date. And that rocket used three distinct substances as propellant, hence the name tripropellant. So what were these three substances? Let's find out, and let's just say they are the reason it stayed firmly on the test stand. Let's start with a nice, normal propellant combination, hydrogen and oxygen. We mix the two in a combustion chamber where combustion takes place. But what actually is combustion? Here's a model of an oxygen atom, and here's a hydrogen one. And yes, all the physicists can sit down, it's a highly simplified model, but it works for this discussion. The hydrogen atom has one energy level, which can house two electrons, but it normally has one. The oxygen atom has two energy levels, the outer of which can house eight electrons, but there are normally six. Atoms want to have a full outer energy level. A full energy level is a more stable configuration, if you will. Normally, hydrogen and oxygen atoms share their outer electrons like this to form a full outer energy level for each atom. But if we break this bond by introducing some energy through, let's say, a spark, we end up with positive hydrogen ions and negative oxygen ions. These rapidly form a new electron-sharing, or covalent, bond and release energy in the process. That energy is heat, and that's what drives your engine, with water as a waste product. Hydrogen is a great fuel, but we can do better. It wants to gain an electron, or we could equally say it wants to lose an electron, I suppose. But that electron is in the smallest possible energy level, close to the positive nucleus, which keeps hold of it. This group on the periodic table is all the elements with one outer electron. They're all highly reactive. They'll give away that outer electron to anything willing to take it. In everyday parlance, I'm referring to a metal fire. That's right, we're going to build a rocket with a controlled metal fire. I already hate that sentence, but that's just the beginning. It may then come as some consolation that the chosen metal for Rocketdyne's engine was lithium. It's the least reactive metal in the group, but it wasn't picked due to safety concerns. Lithium has a low density, and the oxidation of lithium therefore yields one of the highest energies per kilogram of any chemical reaction. There are many, many issues with using lithium as a rocket fuel. First of which, it's a solid at room temperature. So that gave Rocketdyne two unappealing options. Number one would be to line the combustion chamber with solid lithium and flow the oxidizer through it to give a hybrid rocket. Option two would be to hold the lithium above its melting point of 180 degrees centigrade and deliver it as a liquid. I suppose there'd also be option three of trying to feed powdered lithium into a combustion chamber, but just absolutely not. So option one was moot. The study was specifically to evaluate a liquid tripropellant. Hybrids can never achieve the ISP possible in a liquid rocket, as complete combustion is impossible without fully mixing the reactants. So that leaves us with option two, liquid lithium. A good 50% of the final Rocketdyne report discusses the difficulties of handling liquid lithium. Most casual discussion about this engine focuses on the hazards of the oxidizer, and we'll get to that. But in all honesty, the prospect of handling a large quantity of molten lithium sounds worse to me. First of all, that relatively low reactivity for a Group 1 metal. We can kind of forget about that. Molten lithium is significantly more reactive than its solid form. According to the safety data sheet, it reacts spontaneously with air and explosively with water. In fact, it's probably pyrophoric in most cases. That means it ignites on contact with air. And Rocketdyne were atomizing it through nozzles into the combustion chamber. I have very little doubt that atomized lithium droplets are explosive in air. To make things worse, liquid lithium is highly corrosive. You may have seen videos of mercury or gallium removing the oxidized layer on aluminum and destroying it. Lithium does that, just faster. And not just to aluminum. It's corrosive to steel, along with most other metals. Every piece of plumbing and every valve was vulnerable to this aggressive corrosion before and during the tests. Okay, so we have a large tank of pyrophoric and highly corrosive metal at 300 degrees Celsius, which we hope to convert to a metal fire. A metal fire is scary enough. A metal fire in pure oxygen would be worse, but we can do better. Oxygen isn't the best oxidizer. Lithium atoms desperately want to give away their outer electron. What we really need is an element that'll move hell and earth to gain an outer electron. Something that's so desperate to get that electron, it'll happily oxidize oxygen in order to do so. Stop and think about that sentence, by the way. An element that can even rip the electrons from the full outer energy levels of noble gases. Fluorine. For anyone that didn't recoil in horror at the thought of mixing a Group 1 metal with fluorine, here is cold fluorine reacting with a brick. I'm not sure I need to say much else. But to be unambiguously clear, fluorine reacts violently with water, rock, people, pretty much anything that contains electrons. It even reacts with elements in its own group. It'll happily pull the electrons from chlorine, and we'll get to that later. So, Rocketdyne housed 15 fluorine tanks alongside their engine. Most chemists have never even seen fluorine, let alone 15 tanks of it. To make things even more horrifying, it was condensed into its liquid form prior to injection into the engine. At one point in the report, they even discussed a fluorine spill into a concrete holding zone. I dread to think what that looked like. At this point, I should probably mention that the report hilariously never mentioned safety considerations. It goes into great depth on the technical discussions, but casually discusses spraying litres of fluorine around as if it were water. The 1960s sound interesting. Okay, so we're ticking off those hazard pictograms now, and we've initiated one of the most energetic chemical reactions possible, but we can do better. Remember I said the faster the exhaust, the higher the specific impulse? Our exhaust currently consists of the products of lithium and fluorine. That gives relatively heavy compounds. What if we injected a low-density substance into the exhaust and allowed it to be accelerated by all that heat energy? And that's where we complete our trifecta of horror. Liquid hydrogen. By injecting the element with the lowest molecular mass, we achieve the highest possible exhaust speed, boosting our ISP even more. Of course, alongside everything else we've discussed, hydrogen looks positively benign, but it's still highly flammable, and there will be consequences for using it. We'll get to that later. I've used that phrase quite a few times now, haven't I? Safety concerns aside, the use of hydrogen was yet another headache. It required cryogenic storage, so tanks of liquid hydrogen at negative 250 Celsius were positioned meters away from our heated lithium tank. And with our completed GHS hazard pictogram speedrun complete, we can now take a look at how the engine actually functioned.
There's one point I want to make clear. The Rocketdyne tripropellant engine was purely a proof of concept. It didn't get close to flying, let alone being incorporated into a full prototype. The assembly on the test stand was a complex combustion chamber and nozzle. Trivial matters such as pumping liquid lithium through a turbopump were left to hypothetical future designers of a launch-capable engine. I didn't have very much to go off regarding the appearance of the engine, but there are enough schematics and really poorly scanned photos for us to get a good idea of how the assembly looked. Ertem, who did the 3D animation, and I worked to bring what we knew to life. But the surrounding plumbing tanks and even the test shed are representations based on what I could find in the report. The engine itself, though, I know exactly how that was configured thanks to the schematics in the report. Here's how it worked. Surprisingly, although lithium and fluorine react violently, the low temperature of liquid fluorine prevents them reacting fast enough to be used as rocket propellant. So the main combustion chamber required preheating. We already have something to hand that combusts practically instantly on contact with fluorine to release plenty of heat. The hydrogen fuel actually had a second purpose alongside providing low-density exhaust. The first chamber of the engine was a gas generator. Before a test, the plumbing and chamber were purged with helium. Remember, at least two of the propellants here react with air, so we require the least reactive starting configuration we can manage. The fluorine was injected first, followed by a relatively small amount of hydrogen into the gas generator. This highly fluorine-rich environment oxidized the hydrogen to generate hot gas, which was passed through the mixing plates and into the second chamber. Prior to lithium injection, the exhaust hydrogen injectors were opened, allowing for full flow of hydrogen from the nozzle. As was the case with the fluorine, the lithium was injected through numerous nozzles around the circumference of the chamber. We'll talk a little more about these later, as extensive design work went into them. The chamber itself was protected with a graphite liner backed with asbestos. Because, I mean, we've already ticked off everything else, so we might as well stuff this thing with asbestos too. The lithium droplets mixed and reacted with the hot fluorine and released heat. That heat accelerated the already flowing hydrogen through the third chamber and through the nozzle. But hold on a second. Fluorine and hydrogen. Oh no. That makes hydrogen fluoride. When that's exhausted from our engine and reacts with water in the air, we get hydrofluoric acid. That's right, we're still playing hazard bingo. Hydrofluoric acid is actually not a particularly strong acid, but it makes up for that in at least three aspects. First, if you're exposed to it without realising, the burns are initially painless. There are plenty of absolutely awful photos of individuals who got hydrofluoric acid on their skin, only to notice hours later. Secondly, it's toxic, and quite alarmingly so. The real hazard with hydrofluoric acid is the fact it's readily absorbed through the skin. Once inside the body, and through means I don't fully understand, it decomposes back into fluorine, which promptly attacks the calcium in blood and bones. Not a pleasant thought. And finally, what it lacks in strength, it makes up for in variety. Hydrogen fluoride famously dissolves silica, and that means it will happily eat through glass and asbestos. If this engine were actually used in a Stage 1 booster, it had doused the launch pad in a toxic acid capable of dissolving sand. Incidentally, that means it had dissolved the concrete launch pad too. But leaving that hypothetical aside, following a set period, the lithium flow was shut off, and the hydrogen and fluorine flows staged down. Finally, the system was purged again with helium to complete the test firing. Another point of note is the lack of any ignition system. Since fluorine and the two fuels spontaneously ignite on contact, there was no need for one. And that's the engine design. Let's see how it performed in testing. The Rocketdyne study was actually two separate studies. The first, carried out in 1968, was the design and testing of the previously described engine. If you'd heard about this engine prior to watching this video, or you'd seen a paper posted in a Kerbal Space Program forum, for example, chances are it was that first study. The second study, which concluded in 1970, investigated further design improvements and additional performance testing. Let's begin with the first study. That was the one that achieved the almost mythical result of 542 seconds of ISP. That study itself was split into a design and a testing stage. As I've already mentioned, the majority of the paper discusses the difficulties of designing a lithium injection system. There are numerous plots and formulae included for modelling droplet size simulation and multi-phase flow for molten lithium, To ensure complete and consistent combustion, the injection system, which, remember, injected lithium around the circumference of the chamber, needed to produce droplets of a sufficiently small size and within a certain size range, and produce jets with enough momentum to reach the centre of the chamber. Rather than discuss all that maths and all those plots that we used to arrive at the final injector geometry, I thought it'd be more interesting to discuss the testing itself. Various injectors were built with a variety of nozzle sizes and positions, and tested using Kerosafe, which is an alloy of bismuth, lead, tin and cadmium. It has a melting point of 74 degrees Celsius and does not have the high reactivity of lithium. There's an illustration of the test setup here. And that actually leads me to a quick digression. See the Polaroid camera there? Back in the 1960s, Polaroid cameras were awesome. Before my channel suddenly got popular, I was planning on making a video about them. They looked like this. And instead of printing out a photo, you had to pull it out and peel apart the film and the photo, and the quality on them was amazing. Sadly, this film ended manufacture a few years ago. I have a few left, but no one can reverse engineer the formula at the moment. If nobody manages it, this amazing format will soon be extinct. And by the way, I do still plan on making that video in the future. But anyway, back to Rocketdyne. Here are some awful scans of the Polaroids used to evaluate the test lithium injectors. Not only was jet performance analysed, but solidified Kerosafe particles were also collected to evaluate the droplet size. With the lithium injection system design complete, 10 whole pages of the report are dedicated to the lithium plumbing. I'm showing my interpretation of it on screen, but bear in mind, I've not shown every valve and connection, just the basics of the system as described in the report. Every element of the lithium system was surrounded by insulation, reflective foil, and heated to a minimum of 260 degrees Celsius. The system consisted of a lithium tank, feed line, associated valves, and helium purge system. The tank held 25 litres of lithium and consisted of a length of steel pipe with flanges welded on the end. It looked quite crude, like something I used to see on an oil rig, but I suppose it worked. Three valves controlled the flow of lithium, with one allowing flow to the engine, one allowing the purge gas into the system, and one allowing lithium to be vented to atmosphere. The purge system was crucial. Since lithium reacts with air, water, and pretty much anything else, the tank and feed lines were filled with helium when not in use. The helium was flowed through the lines prior to lithium injection to clear out any impurities. This helium was heated to above the melting point of lithium before injection into the system via a purge gas heater. Finally, an emergency freeze jacket was present on the inlet line. In the case of a valve sticking open, this would flow water around that section of the line, freezing the lithium in place and blocking any further flow from the tank. The fluorine system was, on the whole, simpler. Fluorine gas was piped from the tanks and through a cooled condensing coil. This was actually cooled using liquid nitrogen. This fed into an insulated 50-litre fluorine tank. Oh, 50 litres of liquid fluorine is such an unpleasant thought. You may be wondering how it's even possible to get fluorine through the pipework without it reacting with the pipework. And indeed, pumping straight fluorine through steel pipes would destroy them in rapid order. To prevent this, Rocketdyne used a passivization process. You may have heard that aluminum is actually highly reactive, but is normally protected by a thin layer of oxide on the outside. A similar process was exploited here. Nitrogen was pumped through the fluorine system. Gradually, fluorine was introduced to the nitrogen flow over the course of several hours. When a sufficient concentration of fluorine was reached, a passive metal fluoride layer had formed on the inside of the pipework, protecting it. A tedious, yet wholly necessary process. To allow fluids to flow into the combustion chamber, everything was self-pressurized, with the propellant plumbing and pressure vessels rated to 3000 psi, or about 200 bar. The system for injecting hydrogen and inert gas was relatively simple compared to the fluorine and lithium systems, so as shown only in their basic form here, though do bear in mind the hydrogen was stored cryogenically. A total of 11 test firings were carried out using this basic configuration. Valve actuation was controlled via an electronic timer, with the test engineers presumably housed in either a positively pressured bunker or a significant distance from the engine. Somewhat disappointingly, test firings were limited to a maximum of about 10 seconds. I used some creative license with the animations and showed longer firings. The visuals would be pretty boring otherwise. Remember, the study was just a feasibility and basic performance study. Full duration firings would have required handling of far greater quantities of propellant, and they'd require significant time and effort to design a chamber cooling system. As you'd probably expect, issues were encountered on almost every test firing, and the system was altered accordingly. The first two runs resulted in the lithium injectors burning through, necessitating replacement with graphite nozzles. The third firing took place on a particularly hot day. The result was unacceptable heating on the liquid nitrogen lines to the fluorine condenser, resulting in reduced fluorine flow. Two further tests were disrupted by lithium solidifying and plugging the nozzles, and by inconsistent fluorine flow again. The sixth and seventh tests were the first full successful firings, the first time in history a lithium-fluorine-hydrogen engine was successfully fired. Two further tests were successfully carried out with varying hydrogen concentrations, with one of these yielding that magical 542 seconds of ISP. The final two attempted firings failed due to stuck valves and plugged lithium lines, a common theme throughout. But the aim of the program had been met, demonstrating a working system, and with that, the first test program was concluded. The second study built upon the first by investigating alternative hardware configurations and firing conditions. We won't go too much into detail, but let's cover the main outcomes. Unsurprisingly, much of it focused on improving reliability of lithium injection. 15 test firings are recorded in total during the study, and none had the valve or line plugging issues seen in the first study. The second objective was to evaluate different chamber designs. The configuration I walked through earlier used a fluorine-rich gas generator in the first chamber of the engine. This had the disadvantage of running at about 5,000 degrees Celsius. For the avoidance of all doubt, that is absurd. About the temperature of the surface of the sun. Not only would that pose significant challenges to designing something that could physically fly, but it also ionized the exhaust. So, in addition to all the previous issues, we'd end up with a rocket that couldn't receive or broadcast radio transmissions whilst the engines were firing. However, by running the gas generator fuel-rich instead, the temperature was drastically lowered to a comparatively cold 2000 Celsius. The second study, therefore, assessed the performance of a fuel-rich system, and surprisingly, the specific impulse didn't take that big of a hit. 509 seconds of ISP was measured compared to 542 for the fluorine-rich system. I'm honestly not sure how the physics of that work. I'd have assumed a proportionally higher temperature would give proportionally higher exhaust velocity. Maybe the additional hydrogen reduced the overall exhaust density enough to compensate for the loss. Either way, running the engine hydrogen-rich also eliminated the need for the second hydrogen injector ring, simplifying the design. Finally, the second study investigated the performance of the engine in a vacuum. A vacuum nozzle extension was fitted. In the vacuum of space, the exhaust gases are able to expand further due to the lack of ambient pressure, so a larger nozzle provides better performance as it allows the gases to continue pushing back on the engine as they expand. However, testing a vacuum nozzle in atmosphere would destroy it, as atmospheric air gets between the nozzle and exhaust, causing flow instability. So, for firings with the vacuum nozzle, a diffuser was used. This is really just a tube with a constriction that's sealed around the engine. As the exhaust gases flow through the tube, they rapidly entrain any air in the system and carry it out to atmosphere, maintaining a near vacuum around the nozzle for the duration of the firing. For later tests, the nozzle was water-cooled through a water jacket, shown here. This demonstrated the feasibility of regenerative cooling for a hypothetical operational system, though such an arrangement would use hydrogen fuel as a coolant rather than water. Now, I've already said I don't like to call this engine the best performing. I don't like to call it the most dangerous either. There are many, many pathways to failure for an engine that uses fluorine and lithium as fuel, but with proper planning, precautions and management, it's possible to run such a system with an acceptable risk of doing acute harm to people or the environment. And that's exactly what Rocketdyne managed to achieve. There are no records of any lost time incidents as part of either of the tripropellant test programs. All that said, the testing took place at the Santa Susana Field Lab, or SSFL, outside Los Angeles. This vast test site was used for test firings of many pivotal engine designs, along with tangentially related scientific testing. However, the site has a questionable history of safety and environmental incidents. Rocketdyne was founded in the 1950s as a division of the North American Aviation Company. Another division of the same company was Atomics International, and they shared SSFL with Rocketdyne during this period. In 1959, Atomics International became the proud holders of the achievement of first nuclear meltdown in the US. The sodium reactor experiment was an experimental nuclear reactor installed on the site that used the novel approach of using a liquid sodium-potassium alloy to cool the reactor. As the reactor was experimental, frivolities such as reactor shielding were left out. Okay, this is Future Alex doing one of my signature interjections. After a little bit more research, it turns out the sodium reactor was housed underground and surrounded by concrete on three sides. So it was kind of shielded, I suppose. I'm most certainly no nuclear engineer though, so we'll let history be the judge of that. The resulting meltdown and associated environmental release of radioactive material is a separate story told elsewhere on YouTube, but it was far from the only problematic incident at SSFL. Sodium and potassium, also known as NAC in their alloyed form, are Group 1 metals, just like the lithium used in the tripropellant engine. Being further down the group, they're more reactive than lithium. The nuclear reactor, laser research facility, plutonium lab, and other experiments at SSFL, generated significant amounts of contaminated NAC, along with other heavy metals and volatile compounds. Atomics International pursued a very 1950s disposal policy for this assortment of hazardous waste. The volatile waste was packed into barrels and taken outside to what has since come to be known as the burn pit. Now, as someone who used to be involved in the disposal of hazardous materials from the offshore drilling industry, when you hear the phrase burn pit, you know nothing good is going to come of it. There, the barrels were partially submerged in water and shot with a rifle until they exploded. Yeah, all right, I'm done.
The people who work on the hill truly appreciate the natural beauty found here. From the cool shade of an oak grove to a spectacular view of Simi Valley, Rocketdyne keeps a watchful eye on how our environment is treated. Through the dedicated efforts of an environmental staff, ground and surface water are constantly tested for even the slightest amount of contamination. On-site analysis enables Rocketdyne to have the most accurate data available to ensure safe operating conditions.
The exploding barrel story has been echoed many times, so I checked multiple sources to make absolutely sure it happened. And yes, it absolutely happened. There is even a photo of a worker shooting at some barrels here. The part of this story that I couldn't confirm was where the radioactive waste was disposed of using this method, as is commonly claimed. I wouldn't be surprised if low-level waste was burned in this manner, but I can't confirm from any impartial sources. Regardless, this method of waste disposal was still very much in effect at the time Rocketdyne tested out the tri-propellant engine. In fact, it went on until 1994. It only stopped when a barrel of waste prematurely exploded and killed two employees. So, I suppose whilst the tri-propellant engine didn't harm anyone acutely, it may have been a small part of a much larger environmental hazard. I was surprised to see no mention of an exhaust scrubber during test firings, meaning all firings were direct to atmosphere. We've already discussed the dangers of one of the exhaust products, hydrogen fluoride, but the main product would have actually been lithium fluoride. Now, this is chemically quite similar to table salt, and much like table salt, it's actually very good for you in very small quantities. It prevents dental cavities, but anything larger than small quantities of lithium fluoride is toxic, as with most lithium salts, and I've got no idea how effectively it dissipates over time in the environment. The quantities of pollutants created by the tri-propellant tests would have been minuscule in the grand scheme of things, and most engine firings at SSFL didn't produce toxic exhaust products at all. But the substances produced and disposed of at the site to get to those firings have lasting effects to this day. All other factors equal, the lithium fluorine hydrogen engine may be the most dangerous chemical rocket engine ever tested. But it wasn't that much more of a hazard than some engines which have actually flown. Hydrazine and its various derivatives, for example, are toxic, hypergolic, and corrosive. Yet they've been used as a propellant for decades, and while they've been the cause of at least one catastrophe, they're used to this day by NASA for reaction control thrusters. In fact, the tri-propellant concept isn't the most dangerous engine conceived. A major source for this video is the absolutely outstanding book Ignition by John Clark. At one point, he discusses coming alarmingly close to building an engine fueled by dimethylmercury, a neurotoxin so potent a couple of drops on your skin is enough to be fatal. And that's not even me being hyperbolic. Look up the death of Karen Wetterhahn if you want to feel depressed for the next few days. Dimethylmercury makes lithium and fluorine appear benign in comparison. So, following the 1970 study, the question was it possible to incorporate the tri-propellant chemistry into an actual launch vehicle? First stage propulsion was out of the question. Dumping tons of hydrofluoric acid on a launch pad followed by flying tons of liquid fluorine at supersonic speed would be an immediate trip to the top right of the safety matrix. But how about an upper stage that only ignites above the majority of the atmosphere? And in that case, it'd require a far smaller quantity of hazardous propellant too. Or even an orbital stage to convey a probe to interplanetary space. In July of 1970, NASA contracted the space division of Chrysler, yes, that Chrysler, the one that builds the ugly cars, to take Rocketdyne's results and assess the feasibility of such a vehicle. They studied a variety of scenarios, including the upper stages for a Titan III, Atlas Centaur, and even a Saturn V Stage 4B booster. Can you imagine this setup on the top of a Saturn V? For all these launch systems, both direct injection and long-duration missions were considered. A direct injection mission is one where the upper stage is utilised shortly after launch and is immediately discarded. Long-duration missions are those where the upper stage is fired in interplanetary space, for example for a Mars orbital insertion, with around 200 days assumed by the study. Unfortunately, this study concluded that the tri-propellant concept cannot deliver a higher payload than a fluorine hydrogen bipropellant for any long-duration mission scenarios. At first, this may sound confusing. The specific impulse is higher. But specific impulse is far from the only factor when calculating payload fraction. Lithium is relatively lightweight, which sounds ideal for a launch propellant, but it's not that simple. Though the energy per unit mass of lithium is extremely high, a relatively high volume of lithium is required to be flown due to its low density. That means a larger than otherwise lithium tank, and a larger lithium tank requires more insulation and heating elements to keep that lithium molten, adding disproportionately more mass to the entire system. More dense propellants, like that proposed for the neurotoxin rocket I just mentioned, tend to provide lower specific impulses due to the denser exhaust gases. But they can also mean smaller tanks, requiring less structural mass and reduced aerodynamic drag. As many of you will have already guessed, the additional mass required to heat and insulate the lithium more than offsets the benefit. Even with the low heat losses in space, I can't even imagine a space probe with enough solar power collection area to maintain a tank of lithium at 300 degrees Celsius. Materials and power delivery technology at the time simply couldn't provide a light enough system to make lithium a beneficial fuel source. At this point, I'd like to point out one of the worst graphs I've ever seen from the report. This is the projected mass of the power system needed to deliver a given number of kilowatts of power to heat the lithium. It shouldn't even be a graph, you could just write it as a single formula, m equals 0.08p. And they've mixed up the units, SI units on the x-axis and an American standard units on the y-axis. And while we're at it, they're doing that whole using pounds as a unit of force thing on the y-axis there too, or kilopounds as they call them. If you want to use SI prefixes, just use SI units. Awful. Anyway, for direct injection methods, there was a glimmer of hope. The tripropellant system was predicted to be capable of delivering up to about 5% extra payload mass depending on the mission parameters, though Chrysler recommended against taking the concept any further. And probably for the best. For an extra 5% payload at most, I cannot imagine a scenario where it would be cost beneficial to use a tripropellant stage instead of just building a bigger rocket. And that's putting aside all the necessary hazard mitigation we've already discussed at length. So, was the whole investigation a waste of time? Was this just NASA using their practically unlimited space race budget to just mess about? No. I keep coming back to John Clark's Ignition. The book begins by summarising the thousands of other propellant concoctions that were tried before the limited few we actually used to get into orbit was settled on. The history of engineering is full of negative results that had to be discounted before an agreed-upon solution was arrived at. Furthermore, NASA practically wrote the book on handling fluorine. It was subsequently used at SSFL in their laser research facility through the 1980s, and it's used widely elsewhere in many other industrial processes. It's a critical component of the nuclear industry, used to make uranium hexafluoride, a gaseous compound that is centrifuged to isolate the precious uranium-235 that makes up uranium fuel rods. Rocketdyne's work with fluorine contributed towards the safe handling procedures that make these processes possible. And don't forget, though a lithium-fluorine-hydrogen tripropellant engine may not have been feasible on top of a Titan III in 1970, that doesn't mean it'll never be feasible. There's nothing to say advances in lightweight materials, energy storage, or some other technology may eventually allow us to exploit the concept. Perhaps we simply aren't thinking big enough. The additional mass required for heating and insulating a lithium tank becomes less of an issue the larger the tank becomes. That's because doubling the volume of a sphere causes the surface area to increase by a factor of only about 1.6. The bigger the sphere, the lower the surface area to volume ratio. For those not familiar with the concept, it's known as the square cube law. Once you learn about it, you start to see it everywhere. So that means proportionally less surface to heat and insulate, translating to less proportional mass of the entire spacecraft being dedicated to the lithium heating system. This is the reason we don't see small orbital rockets fueled by liquid hydrogen. The small volume would have too high a surface area, requiring proportionally more mass to be dedicated to the thermal insulation for the cryogenic hydrogen. With several new heavy lift systems nearing operational status, and talk of more on-orbit assembly in the coming decades, could we see a spacecraft large enough to make lithium, fluorine, and hydrogen a viable propellant? In my opinion, probably not, but I try not to predict the future too much. I'm usually wrong when I do.
Besides, the research has found at least one other application, just not where you might expect to find it. So now we arrive at the Alex surprises you section of the video. When I pick topics for my videos, I tend to pick things that I have at least some personal experience with, however tangential. And I've been personally involved with a piece of equipment that uses a very similar chemical reaction to Rocketdyne's tripropellant engine. In fact, I'm almost certain the findings of Rocketdyne's studies eventually went on to support the development of this tool. Before revealing what it is, I need to add some context. As I already discussed, a denser propellant is often preferred. We discussed fuel density, but how about the oxidizer? How can we make fluorine more dense? The answer is to use a compound that is comprised mainly of fluorine. Remember, I said fluorine can react with elements in its own group. We can exploit that. John Clark discusses the use of chlorine trifluoride as an oxidizer. One molecule of it decomposes into three fluorine and one chlorine atom at the drop of a pin. Of course, that makes it highly unstable, but I think we're a bit tired of hearing that phrase by now. Crucially, it can deliver more oxidizer per unit mass than raw fluorine can. Okay, so now let's discuss my previous career. I used to work in the oil and gas industry. The majority of my work was around abandoning old oil wells. The process of doing so is more complex than many realise, so we won't go into full details now. But at the simplest level, an oil well consists of a cased hole through which metal tubing is run. The tubing carries the oil to surface and is typically between about 7 and 15 centimetres in diameter. Yes, I converted to metric, and yes, I would like to do a full video on the lunacy that is oilfield units sometime. Before abandoning a well, this tubing must be cut often thousands of metres below the surface and then retrieved to the surface. So how do we deliver enough energy through a small bore to cut through the steel tubing? If you can think of an answer, someone sells something that does it already. Explosives, thermite, mechanical tools, abrasive tools, even lasers. There are many ways to make the cut. Before I worked in the industry, the most common method was to use linear shape charge explosives. These usually do the job and are still often used where necessary, but they come with a whole host of issues. First of all, of course, being safety. The amount of paperwork and procedures required to handle explosives on an offshore platform make them something of a last resort. They're used for many other purposes in the field, but avoided if possible. Explosive cutters were superseded by chemical cutters as the most popular choice here in the UK. Many oil workers think chemical cutters work by spitting acid at the pipe to cut it, but there is no acid remotely strong enough to nearly instantaneously cut steel pipe. What chemical cutters actually are a rearranged form of a tripropellant rocket engine. Instead of chlorine trifluoride, they contain bromine trifluoride, a similar compound but slightly more stable. This is sealed in a section of the tool that is, for all intents and purposes, impossible to open at surface. A separate chamber contains metal wool in a flammable hydrocarbon fuel. The tool is run to the required cut depth and triggered. Exactly how they triggered depends on the tool itself. From what I remember, I think they tended to require balls to be dropped down the tubing and pumped to a certain pressure. Some of them may use an electrical signal, but that'd require most of the same precautions as using explosives. They were also electrically triggered and so required the platform to go radio silent, post someone on watch for lightning, that kind of thing. When triggered, the fluoride oxidizer would react with the fuel, with extra energy provided by the oxidization of the metal wool. This would blow out ports around the circumference of the tool, creating little jets of superheated exhaust, which would hopefully cut the tubing. Chemical cutters have since largely been superseded by radial cutting torches, which use something similar to thermite. They have all the advantages of a chemical cutter with greater stability, and therefore less of an inherent safety risk. Chemical cutters and radial cutting torches may sound hazardous, But due to careful design, they carried less risk than explosives, and are therefore less hassle to operate. Safety standards in the UK oil industry are extremely stringent, and I'm not aware of any major safety incidents caused by a chemical cutter malfunction, demonstrating that it is indeed possible to harness what on the surface appears to be an untamable process. I was around on a couple of occasions when both explosives and chemical cutters were used on a platform, and I will say, it's really boring. The amount of proper process and procedure to go through when handling hazardous goods reduces the operation to something slow and methodical. And that is by design. I'm sorry if that disappoints you. Well, at this point, I normally wrap things up with a nice conclusion. But I think I've said everything I can already. So thank you very much for watching. If you really like what I do, I've just set up a Patreon, a link in the description for anyone interested in the odd behind-the-scenes video. If you've made it this far, I think a reward is in order. And what better reward than the Rocketdyne safety wrap? Okay, let me give you the context. Not that it helps much. When researching for this video, I came across an upload of an internal Rocketdyne video from 1992. Incidentally, that's 2 years before those two employees blew themselves up with the exploding barrel. It starts off with the president delivering an update on operations and the division's various challenges and recent successes. You know, all rather boring stuff. Then, all of a sudden, everyone just kind of gets up and starts singing. There isn't really much more I can add. Just go and visit Dutch Steam Machine's channel for the full video. He uploaded it from an original VHS. I'll be back soon to talk about the Minuteman missile, its guidance system, and how it actually relates to Rocketdyne. Until then, please enjoy this assault on the senses.
I'm here to say, you shouldn't drive to work alone each and every day. If you ride with two, maybe three or four, we'll clean the air and this pollution thing is out the door.
You know, one of the things that I hate to see is someone living life so carelessly. So buckle your belt, snap it in place. It's better to be safe, just in case.
Commitment to the environment.
I know you heard, but I'm saying again, don't ever throw your oil down the drain. Just plan ahead. It's not real tough. There are many better ways to dispose of this stuff.
The laser printer, it's a cool machine. Makes briefings look better, really nice and clean. The toner is stored in this device. But when it's all gone, take this advice. Don't throw it away. It can be refilled. Then you can use it once again. Aren't you just thrilled?
Safety shades. Crazy cool. Why do I wear them? Well, I ain't no fool. They protect my eyes in emergencies. So tell your friends to wear them. Won't you do that, please?
Commitment to the environment.
Chemicals. This is potent stuff. And that's the very reason I can't stress enough. Keep them labeled and properly stored. Just use your common sense. It should not be ignored. These are the things that must be learned. It's the right thing to do so you don't get burned.
My closet is full, they're the clothes I like. I have dresses and gowns are fun to wear at night. When at work, I must confess, I wear gloves, I wear a shield, and an apron no less. I know these clothes aren't the latest trend, but when I'm working here, they protect my skin. And that ain't no joke.